with emails that are just filling up my inbox, he launched, seeming incredulous that he had to deal with this issue. And 98% of those are women that are afraid that it will permit, or not stop, sexual predators from using those public accommodations. Senator Simpson was referring to emails from supporters of the Delaware Family Policy Council. After the DFPC's executive director, Nicole Tice, and her supporters had come off as too venomous in the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing the week before, they decided to remain quiet during the full Senate debate and allow conservative legislators to carry their water. Senator Simpson asked Mark, "How will this bill prevent that from happening? And show me in the bill language where that scenario will not be permitted." "Well, I think the answer is that language is in the criminal code," Mark calmly offered back. "The language that prohibits it is in the criminal code. And today, if a predator goes into a bathroom and commits a crime, then that is prohibited. And this bill does not change that. This bill does not permit someone to pretend to be of a different gender identity and go into a bathroom and commit a crime." Simpson shot back. "You're saying the bill does not allow it or does not promote it, but how does it stop it? You said that the bill doesn't allow someone to dress as a woman just to do that, but it doesn't stop it." Mark again patiently responded, explaining that the non-discrimination law provides no cover to a person committing a crime. Delaware had passed protections based on sexual orientation a few years ago, but that law didn't allow or facilitate a man intent on harming a boy in a restroom to do so. With the questions taking a nosedive into the bathroom conversation, Senator Henry interrupted by calling Beau Biden's deputy, Patty Daly Lewis, to testify. Patty had testified in front of the legislature before, but never for something as high profile. "First, let me just say that the Attorney General does support this bill and that the Attorney General would never support any legislation that would put children at harm," she began. After she reiterated some of the points Mark had just made, Senator Simpson leapt back up and challenged her. "It seems logical that if we are telling people that they can go into the opposite sex bathrooms, that it would be that sexual predators would do so." "It does not permit sexual predators in," she began responding when Senator Simpson interrupted her. "Well, certainly it doesn't permit sexual predators, but it allows people who are sexual predators to do it," he retorted, the first half of his sentence contradicting the second half of his sentence. "No, it does not," Patty shot back. "A sexual predator, regardless of their excuse to be in any room, is not permitted to harm someone. And to take that argument a step further, we have people on the sex offender registry, not transgender folks, but non-transgender folks, on the child protection registry and the sex offender registry today, that are permitted to go into bathrooms, the same bathrooms with the kind of people they have offended against." Her point highlighted the opportunism of these arguments. For all of the talk of sexual predators accessing restrooms, these senators were holding transgender people's right to safely access a restroom to a higher standard than the current ability of actual certified sex offenders to access restrooms. Senator Simpson, increasingly argumentative, repeated various versions of the same question. Exasperated, he closed with, "Women don't want a man in their restroom. This bill allows it." "It allows a transgender person," she began. "Or a man wearing a wig and a skirt," Simpson interjected, interrupting her again. Patty corrected him. "That's not a transgender person." Simpson asked how she would prove that. Patty jumped at that question. "We're talking about the utilization of a restroom, which for most of us will take a mere 2 to 4 minutes. If a person goes in and does something that violates the criminal code, that's different than them needing to use a restroom that's there." "But does it condone the possibility of a predator saying they are transgender?" Simpson retorted. "If you were harassing someone," Patty tried to explain, "it wouldn't matter if a female was following the child into the bathroom or a male was doing it. It is not permitted." Not understanding how the crime he was talking about would still be illegal, Simpson again retorted, "And then when you confront the person, that's his alibi. I perceive myself as female." Maintaining her composure, Patty tried again to reason with the senator. "But that alibi isn't to the offense. It was to why you were in that room. If it was a female predator going into a female bathroom going after girls, or a male predator going into a male bathroom to go after boys, the fact that they were going after a child in and of itself is the offense. It's not where they were doing it. A teacher who goes after a child in a school can't say, "I'm a teacher, so I'm allowed to be here." It doesn't matter that you are allowed to be there. The debate was going in circles. But by now, Simpson, either realizing he was beating a dead horse or understanding the absurdity of his points, sat back down. And another conservative senator, Colin Benigni, stood up. Senator Benigni is an imposing figure, and while younger than most of his colleagues, is as conservative as they come. He is a contrarian through and through. Even when a vote is 20 strong in favor, he'll be the one dissenting voice. Benigni rose from his desk in the back row, and with a raised voice asked Patty the same questions the other senators had just asked. When she reiterated her responses, his voice raised even higher. "I have never been so offended by testimony. She's not answering truthfully." An audible gasp went through the chamber as Senator Benigni effectively accused Patty of perjury. Patty Daly Lewis had spent 28 years defending the interests of children against predators. She was a well-respected attorney, fair-minded and thoughtful. A Democratic senator jumped up. "Mr. President," the senator said, addressing Matt Den, the presiding officer, "that's an inappropriate comment." Matt Den responded from the dais, instructing Benigni to refrain from such language, a rare admonishment of a senator for disrespectful behavior. I was fed up by this point. I wanted these senators to say these arguments to my face. I asked Mark and Lisa if I could speak again, and they passed a note to Senator Henry. "Call Sarah up." A minute later, I made my way back to the podium, now more angry than nervous. They had insulted Patty. They had figured out every possible way to insinuate that transgender women are men. They had painted basic protections for transgender people as a threat. "You heard some of the questions raised today. Would you like to make a comment?" Senator Henry asked me open-endedly. As Senator Henry spoke, I again looked up into the gallery and at the faces of the transgender people and their families who had come to watch the debate. My heart ached that they had just spent an hour hearing a debate about their dignity and rights devolve into an argument about pedophiles and predators. I thanked the senator for the opportunity to come back up, and in a tone probably a bit too heated, I called the arguments logical fallacies. "There are 14 states and 100 cities and counties that have public accommodations laws that allow transgender people to utilize restrooms in accordance with their gender," I said forcefully. "And there has not been a single documented instance of a transgender person or a person claiming to be transgender going into a restroom or going into a locker room and doing anything that harms people or assaults people." My train of thought was momentarily broken as I noticed Andy make his way into the back of the chamber. The Senate had started discussing our bill a bit earlier than anticipated, and because he was driving up from Washington, Andy had missed most of the debate. Like our first date and that day in the White House, I was immediately struck by how handsome he looked, how suave he seemed as he walked with his hand confidently stuffed in his suit pants pocket to one of the open seats next to my parents with a proud smirk on his face. I snapped back into the moment, invigorated by Andy's presence, and continued with my rebuttal. After a long, heated, explicit, and vivid debate, I was nervous that even a senator or two on the Democratic side had potentially been swayed, or at least made more hesitant to vote for our bill. I wanted to use an analogy that would make them fully understand just how absurd these points would be judged by history. These are the same arguments that have been utilized in every single battle for basic protections and human dignity. They were used to deny equal rights to gay people. They were wrong then, and it is wrong now. Some might wonder why we put up such a defense over bathrooms on our side. Why not just exclude them from the bill to diminish the opposition? Those questions miss the point that bathrooms are just an excuse. If it were not bathrooms, our opponents would find something else to object to. And clearly, they are willing to concoct any kind of scenario, no matter how absurd, to oppose our protections. But even if the opposition was rooted entirely in bathrooms, that doesn't change the fact that it is vital that these non-discrimination protections include restrooms. As the gendered space most frequently accessed by every person, they are particularly dangerous for transgender people. 2 years before our debate, an online video had surfaced of a violent attack against a transgender woman after she tried to use a woman's restroom at a Baltimore-area McDonald's. The woman was beaten so severely she appeared to suffer a seizure. Unlike the dramatic bathroom scenarios imagined by our opponents, the video of the beating of that transgender woman was a real and vivid assault in a bathroom, and representative of an all-too-common experience. One study found that 70% of transgender women in one community reported being verbally harassed, denied access, or physically assaulted in a public restroom. And because of that discrimination and the fear of it, transgender people are often forced to avoid bathrooms altogether, sometimes causing medical issues because we're forced to hold it in for so long. But it's also important to remember that when we're talking about trans equality generally and non-discrimination protection specifically, we're not just talking about bathrooms. The bill also impacted employment, housing, insurance, and all public spaces, not just restrooms. And with the exception of my initial testimony and my parents' testimony, the hour-long floor debate had revolved entirely around restrooms. I didn't want the senators to lose the forest for the trees, so I made sure to highlight some of the discrimination experienced outside restrooms. Lisa, Mark, and I know someone who was hired for a job at a grocery store. They were given the job, put on the schedule. The moment the employer found out that they were transgender, they were fired. I know a young transgender woman who recently transitioned. She had patronized a restaurant for years. And the moment she came out and she went to that restaurant, they said to her, "You can never come back here." I leaned into the microphone. "Ever. And there is no legal recourse for her in this state. 14 states have these laws, and there is not one issue. And to suggest that it would happen in Delaware is disingenuous and not based in reality." I headed back to my seat, still seething. I had exchanged tears for anger, and I was worried I had been too hostile. "Was that too much?" I whispered to Mark. "No, that's exactly what they needed," he assured me. "Plus, I think it's exactly what those kids in the balcony needed. They needed to see someone like you stand up to that bullshit." The few Republicans who stood up again, including Senator Benigni, now offered far more muted opposition, focusing instead of on bathrooms, on liability around discrimination claims. Their protests, harsh and forceful before, had turned almost sheepish, their tone resembling that of a recently admonished child. The striking change in the tone of the debate underscored for me the centrality of trans voices in these efforts. When transgender people stand up, when our voices are heard, when we confront these myths about bathrooms head on, we can make the politics of fear and division, of discrimination and misinformation ineffective. After roughly 2 hours, Senator Henry finally called for a vote. Lisa, Mark, and I sat with pens in our hands and a tally sheet with every senator's name and boxes for yes, no, not voting, and absent next to each one of them. We needed 11 votes to pass the bill, which means we needed to hold every senator who told us yes prior to the debate. Den instructed the clerk to call the roll. Senator by senator, the clerk called each name. "Senator Blevins." "Yes." We began checking the boxes on our tally sheet. "Senator Benigni." "No." Then one not voting. Another yes. Another no. Two more yeses. Another not voting. The roll call continued, the yeses and noes alternating with almost each name. Finally, it concluded. I squeezed my mom's hand and looked expectantly at Mark and Lisa. "Mr. President," the clerk reported, "the roll call on Senate Bill 97 is 11 yes, 7 no, 2 not voting, 1 absent." We had done it. Having received its constitutionally required majority vote, Senate Bill 97 has passed the Senate, the lieutenant governor announced. As his gavel hit the dais, the gallery erupted in cheers. My mom was crying as she embraced Senator Henry, thanking her for her leadership. Lisa hugged me and said, 11 votes, not one vote to spare. You don't pass a bill when you can win in a landslide. You pass the bill when you have just enough votes. But there was only one person I wanted to see. I looked around to find Andy. A crowd of people hugging and celebrating parted, allowing him to make his way through. I ran up to him and he gave me a big hug and kiss. I'm so proud of you, Bean. So proud of you. Before I could respond, Lisa touched my shoulder from behind. I believe there are a few people hoping to speak with you, she said as she gestured toward a group of reporters standing in the hallway outside the chamber. I walked with Andy past the senators and toward the media, catching a glimpse of the gallery. Seeing transgender people and their family members exchanging hugs and shedding a few tears made the 2 hours of insulting debate worth it. Speaking into several microphones and tape recorders held up near my face, and with Andy proudly looking on from just a few feet away, I thanked the 11 senators who voted for our bill and declared, "Today, the Senate sent a powerful message to transgender Delawareans that the heart of this state is big enough to love them too." The vote result was a big step. It was no easy feat, but there wasn't much time for celebration. We were only halfway through the process. And while our whip count had us with enough votes to win in the state house, within minutes of our bill passing the Senate, we started getting troubling reports. Our vote count in the House was collapsing. Chapter 7. One Step Closer to Justice. After an emotional and volatile win in the Senate, I didn't have time to enjoy our success before we had to begin gearing up for our fight in the state house, one that might be even harder. After our opponent's loss in the Senate, they readied for a full court press in the House. The Delaware Family Policy Council, the DFPC, having seen the power of families in our advocacy, blasted out an email to their lists calling on conservative women and their children to show up for the House committee hearing to oppose SB 97. Before a bill comes to the floor of the full chamber, it must first make its way through a smaller committee hearing. Just a week after the Senate vote, 7 excruciating, stressful days spent trying to firm up anxious, supportive legislators, the bill was heard at the State House Administrative Committee. The email from the DFPC worked. Dozens of mothers showed up to testify, in many cases dragging their kids along, too. Emboldened by the stereotypes spoon-fed to them by the DFPC, the mom's testimony largely threw out the subtlety of the arguments we had heard from the Republican senators, who bent over backward to make clear that they weren't talking about transgender people, but rather individuals pretending to be transgender. The professed distinction between transgender people and individuals pretending to be transgender was disingenuous from the start, a dog whistle that lost its nuance with the larger public. As I waited to testify, I stood behind a line of mothers who stepped up one by one, clutching their children tightly as though they were in some sort of danger in legislative hall. Most of the women were middle-aged, some wearing t-shirts with trite anti-trans slogans like "God made men and women" and "No men in women's restrooms," language the LGBTQ community would see in future non-discrimination fights. In their speeches, one woman referred to us as freaks, another as sinners. But predators was once again the word of the day. Standing behind these women, I could feel the disdain they held for transgender people, or at least who they thought we were. It was palpable. My palms were sweaty as I patiently waited my turn to speak. Intellectually, I knew that their prejudice, their hate, was a byproduct of their ignorance. They had been exposed only to lies and distortions about who transgender people are, and not just from the head of the DFPC, who stood in front of me, but also from the media, pop culture, and too many pulpits. As we waited in a line that led to the lectern in the center of the room, the head of the DFPC turned around and introduced herself to me. Her seemingly warm smile and respectful introduction belied the clear contempt she held for people like me. Hatred so deep that it compelled her to spend her life opposing the rights of LGBTQ people. She stepped up to the lectern first to deliver her remarks in opposition. I moved to her side, making sure that everyone could see my face as she delivered her hateful talking points. When she closed, it was my turn. I stepped up to the lectern and delivered the same remarks I had given in the Senate, an introduction of myself and my humanity. And as I spoke, looking out at a sea of faces assembled to oppose my rights, I could see discomfort slowly cross the faces of many of the moms who had shown up to oppose our bill. It wasn't discomfort at being in the presence of a trans person. It was discomfort at the slow realization that the caricatures they had in their minds were unfounded. It was discomfort at the guilt they were clearly feeling as I outlined in emotional terms the simple fact that I am a human being. Their shame was visible. Fortunately, the mobilization by the DFPC didn't stop the bill, at least at that point. The committee voted it through and to the full House by a vote of 4-0. Among those four was a moderate Republican woman from a suburb of Wilmington. I was surprised by her vote. My mother and I had met with her a few days prior, but despite her voting for sexual orientation non-discrimination protections in 2009 and knowing my mother for years, we didn't anticipate that she would end up voting for our bill. Her comments in the meeting with my mother and me hinted as much. When she voted to move the bill out of the committee and on to the full House, I was impressed. Perhaps she's had a change of heart, I thought. As she packed up her papers from the dais, I walked up to her. Thank you for your vote, Representative. You're welcome, but I want you to know I won't be voting for the bill when it comes to the floor, she replied. You know us. You know our family. Why can't we count on your support? She coolly informed me that it's just too soon. You haven't done enough public education yet. The public isn't ready for this. I tried to reason with her. Representative, people are losing their jobs and their homes. Without these protections, transgender people don't feel safe stepping out publicly. It takes a huge risk to educate. It's just too soon. When you ask transgender people to allow a conversation to occur before you grant us equal rights, you are asking people to watch their one life pass by without dignity and respect, I said. The question has been called, Representative. Either you vote for the protections or vote for discrimination. It is as simple as that. I voted for the gay rights bills, she offered in her defense. Then explain to me why you believe my brother should be protected, but not me. I'm a good person, she said, almost pleading for forgiveness. She wanted me to absolve her of her guilt for voting no. But I wouldn't give in. Then show me that with your vote. Otherwise, it's just words. I walked away. Frankly, that representative was the least of my worries. The nerves among the Democratic ranks were fraying, particularly after witnessing the brigade of conservative women show up for the committee hearing. The calls and emails against the bill were starting to compete with the numbers on our side. Word was coming back to us that we were losing votes. During the few excruciating days between the committee vote and the full House's vote, Mark, Lisa, and I met with our field team in the war room we had set up in a downtown Wilmington law firm to strategize and reach out to legislators on the fence. The usually calm and tranquil Lisa and Mark were clearly concerned about the vote count. She is very, very nervous, Lisa told me, referring to one legislator from downstate Delaware, the more conservative region of the state. If this legislator rescinded her support, we could anticipate other less progressive representatives and more conservative districts would flip too. I'm not sure if we can hold her. She was actually crying and told me, I gave Sarah my word. I had met with that legislator during the whip count and she told me she was a firm yes. That was before the anti-equality forces geared up for the fight and inundated her with emails and calls. Legislators are constantly required to balance their own beliefs with the positions of their constituents. On some issues, such as traffic patterns, it makes sense to exclusively represent the needs and interests of your district. But on other issues, legislators are elected to exercise their own judgment. That's why we elect our representatives instead of making every decision by referendum. What's right isn't always what's most popular. And when it came to what Andy called first principles, issues such as equal rights, there was just no excuse. Should I go meet with her? I offered, thinking that if she was emotional about her commitment to me, then seeing me might reinforce her resolve. Knowing the currency of their word among these legislators, Lisa said we should do the exact opposite. This was the moment that the whip count was built for. We don't want to give her a chance to go back on her word. If you meet with her, that gives her the opportunity to change her commitment. No, Lisa continued. We need to make sure she feels the love and firm up her spine. But her standing commitment to you might be the one thing that keeps her on our side. so we had our field team work to increase the number of calls from our supporters in her district. If you see her, run the other way, Lisa remarked, only half-jokingly. The other faction of votes we were slowly losing was from a group of older and middle-aged men in the Democratic caucus. Moderates, one and all, these legislators were already uncomfortable with the issue at hand. I think we need to bring out the big guns, Lisa said, referring to the governor. We had held off on having Jack wade too deeply into the fight, reserving his political capital for a bind precisely like this one. I had served as our primary liaison to Jack, meeting with him routinely to update him on the vote proceedings and getting his advice on messaging and tactics. I stepped out of the conference room and called him. We need your help. I traded calls with him all day, touching base each time he spoke with one of the shaky moderate good old boys. A request from the governor carries a different weight than an ask from anyone else. Even for these legislators, being called directly by the governor wasn't a normal occurrence, and knowing that they would likely eventually need something from Jack made saying no all the more difficult. I don't know if I convinced him, he'd recount. These guys are pretty conservative. Some of them are Democrats just because they grew up Democrats. Nevertheless, the calls from the governor were intrinsically helpful, demonstrating that this was a priority for him. He usually didn't actively lobby on particular bills like this. We worked through the weekend on these legislators, trying to figure out any pressure points we could exert. But eventually, we ran out of time. I woke up on the day of the House vote, June 18th, unsure that we had enough yeses to pass the bill. And just as my family and I prepared to leave for the 40-minute drive to Dover, I got a call from Mark. We're going to have to amend the bill, he told me. There just aren't enough votes. Too many Democrats are scared over bathrooms. Fuck. I started pacing around my family's living room as Andy waited on the couch next to my mom and my brother Sean, who had come down to be with us on what we had anticipated would be the final day. Even an acceptable amendment would mean we'd have to go back to the Senate to have it approve the new version of the bill. I worried that there wouldn't be an appetite to revisit what had been a contentious vote in the upper chamber. What's the amendment going to look like? I asked. We're working on it now, Mark said, referring to the lawyers, including himself, meeting in a room at Legislative Hall to iron out the language. It would, one, clarify that gender identity may be demonstrated by consistent and uniform assertion of the identity or other evidence that it is part of a person's core identity. Two, it will allow for reasonable accommodations to be made in facilities like locker rooms. The first clause was in response to the continued argument that a person might pretend to be transgender in order to enter a sex-specific facility. It tried to reinforce what had been our messaging all along, that trans identities are deeply held, not some wake up in the morning and decide to do it kind of thing. The language was left open-ended and vague so as to not require presentation of evidence to, say, enter the restroom. It also contained a key legal word. May. May, as opposed to shall, makes the entire sentence optional. Fine, I begrudgingly thought. The second clause was more of an actual compromise. While it didn't impact restrooms where there were already partitions, it did allow for businesses with locker rooms to make accommodations specifically for transgender people so long as we were still allowed to utilize facilities consistent with our gender identity. For instance, a curtain could be installed and they could request a transgender woman change her clothes behind it within the women's locker room. Transgender people are concerned for their privacy just like everyone else. Many of us are already petrified of being in a locker room. And to the degree that we utilize them, we are in and out as quickly as possible without drawing attention to ourselves. That a transgender person could be separated from everyone else was stigmatizing. The discomfort of others shouldn't be grounds for differential treatment. And when you do that, when you single us out, it puts a bullseye on our backs for harassment and bullying and reinforces the prejudice that we are not really the gender we are. The language in the amendment was discriminatory, but the choice before me was between passing the rest of the bill with the language, potentially having a worse amendment added, or passing no bill at all. And we needed to make a decision within the next 2 hours. Okay, I responded tentatively, thoroughly unsure of my decision to agree to the compromise amendment. As Andy and I drove down to Dover, I had him review the language of the amendment. I needed a lawyer who was trans to take a look. I needed to know that it would work. The amendment wasn't great, but he thought that the language might allow us to get around it in regulations, meaning that the wording was vague enough that we could interpret it after the fact in a way that left it relatively toothless, erasing as much negative impact as possible. When we arrived at Legislative Hall, I walked into the House Majority Leader's office to see Mark, Lisa, and our prime sponsor Brian Short huddled over a table. Everyone was dressed to the nines, wearing their Sunday best in anticipation of what they too hoped would be the final day of the battle, followed by a signing ceremony with the governor that evening. But now that we were going to have to go back to the Senate, it all felt for naught. Mark walked towards me in a huff. "We have another problem." A Democratic member in his own misguided attempt to bridge the divide on the bill had drafted his own amendment without consulting anyone. His potential amendment would make bathroom access determined by one's assigned sex at birth, meaning that if we ended up using restrooms at all, trans women would have to use the men's room, and trans men would have to use the women's room. "Are you fucking kidding me?" I screamed. My normal restrained use of the F-word was flowing freely that morning. The amendment was about as discriminatory as you can get. It didn't exclude bathrooms from the protections. It effectively banned transgender people from restrooms consistent with our gender identity. It was similar to the policy that conservatives would pass in North Carolina 3 years later. But it was even worse because it wouldn't be limited to just government buildings like the future HB2. The proposed amendment would set discriminatory bathroom policies in every workplace and business impacted by the law. The legislator in question wasn't a bigoted person, just ignorant on the topic. He was sincerely trying to help, but in his failure to consult with any of us and come in at the 11th hour as a hero, he had drafted the worst amendment possible. "We'll kill our own bill if this gets added, right?" I asked. "We'll have to kill it," Mark confirmed. The thought of losing the entire bill after coming so far was disheartening and incredibly frustrating. But permanently passing into law a ban on trans people in bathrooms consistent with our gender identity was poison. If trans people can't access restrooms consistent with who we are, it becomes almost impossible to participate in public life. The other non-discrimination protections wouldn't mean much if we couldn't leave our homes for more than 2 hours. And if we had the gall to use the restroom of our gender, the language would only embolden the already dangerous discrimination that transgender people face in those spaces. "I think he'll pull the amendment if we can get to him," Mark said. "But if it gets filed," referring to the process of formally submitting a bill or amendment to the House clerk, "it may become impossible to defeat the amendment. Republicans and moderate Democrats will jump on it, and they may have enough votes to add it to the bill." Simply put, if the bad amendment were made public, it would likely become an unstoppable force. We'd have to kill our own bill. I raced to the representative's office to try to stop him. He wasn't there. "Shit, he's filed the amendment," I thought. I ran down 2 flights of stairs to the basement room where legislators formally file bills and amendments with the nonpartisan clerk. I asked if they had seen the legislator in question. "No." Thank God. As I ran back upstairs to his office, I came across my mom. Knowing the power of her presence, I told her to join me, and we both hurried to the legislator's office to camp outside. While we waited there, we filed our own amendment. Problematic as it may have been, it was one we could live with. Eventually, the representative I was waiting for arrived. He's a jovial man, warm and friendly, supportive of the bill, but clearly failing to grasp the central controversy of the legislation. "I heard about your amendment," I told him. I didn't want to seem argumentative, lest he get defensive. "And while I want to thank you for trying to help us out, we've drafted an amendment that we think will satisfy concerns." A simple thanks, but no thanks. "Oh, that's great," he said, completely unaware that he had almost destroyed our bill. "So you won't be filing your amendment?" I hesitantly asked. "I guess not. I was just trying to help. But if you all have a solution, that's great," he happily responded. "Thank you. Thank you. We are so appreciative of your support for this bill." I jumped up to shake his hand. He was probably confused by my enthusiastic reaction, not knowing the heart attack he almost gave all of us. Now wasn't the time to pile on to him for his almost fatal mistake. I ran across Legislative Hall to meet Mark and Lisa outside the office of the leader of the Senate, Patty Blevins, one of the two women who sponsored our bill in that chamber. We sat in silence as we waited for her to get out of a meeting. We needed to inform her that there would be an amendment, and that should the bill make it through the House, it would have to come back to the Senate. As supportive as Senator Blevins had been, we worried that her caucus would balk at the second vote, and that political exhaustion would end up destroying our chances for getting the bill all the way to Jack's desk for his signature. The amendment was our only way to save the bill in the House, but it could end up destroying the bill anyway if the Senate was feeling cowardly. Finally, Blevins was ready to see us. Lisa explained that we were adding an amendment in the House and that we need to return to the Senate. We all held our breath as we waited for her to respond. Blevins let out a frustrated exhale. We weren't sure whether she was frustrated that the House couldn't stand up to the bigotry of the bathroom arguments like the Senate had done, or because the Senate would have to deal with the issue again. Even though Lisa asked the question, Senator Blevins looked right at me. "This is the most important bill we will vote on this year. If you can pass the bill through the House early enough today, we'll take it back up immediately tonight. But if it passes too late today, we'll take it up first thing tomorrow." With that, she stood up from her desk and, continuing to look at me, said, "Don't worry. We won't let you down." After three different fires that morning, all our ducks were in a row. We just needed enough Democrats to return to our side to give us a majority of 21. While the Democrats met upstairs, we waited patiently but nervously in the lobby. The House caucus meeting was dragging on and on. Minutes turned into hours. There were clearly disagreements. I sat there and talked with Andy to pass the time, playing boring games like tic-tac-toe and hangman. I could hardly focus, my nerves overwhelming any other thoughts. As we played, I heard someone call my name. "Sarah?" I turned around to see an angry woman, maybe one of the moms who had showed up to the committee hearing the previous week. "I just have one question for you. Have you had the surgery yet?" "I don't think that is any of your business," I replied, stunned. To this day, it always amazes me when people think they are entitled to information about my body. I would never ask a stranger about their genitals. But I quickly got the sense that this woman didn't care if she was imposing, let alone offending me. "Oh, I think it is my business," she insisted. "And if I ever see you in a women's bathroom with me, I'll chop it right off." Still processing the initial rudeness, I almost didn't realize what the woman had just said to me. That she would assault me if she saw me in the restroom. Andy, who was still standing right next to me, jumped in. "Ma'am, that is completely out of line," he said, pulling me away from the situation and offering her the respect she was unwilling to offer us. He walked me over to Lisa and Mark, and astounded and angry, I recounted the exchange to them. "That woman threatened to violently assault you," Mark remarked, shocked at her comments. He suggested I report the woman to the Capitol Police. I reluctantly decided to do it. I wanted a record of this woman's comments and threat of physical violence. But I was embarrassed and worried about the reaction I'd get from the officers. I didn't want to talk to them about my body, even if it was just in reference to the comments the woman had made. I was worried they'd laugh at me. Frankly, in the grand scheme of things, being laughed at by the police would have been a relatively tame encounter for a transgender person interacting with law enforcement. One survey found that among transgender people who had interacted with a police officer who thought or knew that they were transgender, 58% reported mistreatment. That might include officers unintentionally or intentionally disrespecting trans people's identities by calling them by the wrong pronoun. It could include profiling of trans women as sex workers, a presumed offense many people call walking while trans. For others, it could include violence. And for trans women of color, the risk of this treatment skyrockets. These experiences led more than half of transgender people overall to say that they were uncomfortable asking the police for help. Even though my race, social status, and the setting ensured that being laughed at was the most I had to worry about, I was still apprehensive. But I stepped into the small office of the Capitol Police, right next to the metal detectors and X-ray machine at the entrance of the building. Word for word, I told the officers what had happened. I wasn't laughed at, but I didn't get the impression that the officers cared much for my report. They implied that the woman's threat was par for the course. They suggested that it was what I got for working publicly to pass a controversial bill. They're probably right, I thought. But as I walked over to the House chamber with Andy to wait in a part of the building away from the woman who threatened me, I realized the absurdity of that suggestion. No one should ever be threatened with violence for exercising their constitutional right to advocate to their elected representatives. I had come to terms with the physical risk of advocacy, but that doesn't mean I should have to tolerate it. The threat of violence shouldn't be part and parcel of advocating for your own dignity. Was I surprised that someone threatened me? No. But the fact that it wasn't surprising should be an outrage. It further underscored the need for the bill, and in particular for protections from discrimination and harassment in restrooms. It also brought front and center the risk of being the public face of a bill that came with the potential for retribution. You can get lost in the fear that comes with that risk. It can consume you. But I just had to do my best to put it in the back of my mind. There was too much work to do and too many people for whom that fear was even more warranted. Finally, at about 3 p.m., the caucus broke and we anxiously awaited any news on the preliminary vote they had taken in the meeting. A few minutes later, the Speaker of the House entered through a side door of the chamber and caught my eye. He gave Mark, Lisa, and me a thumbs up. "We've got it," Lisa quietly but confidently affirmed. Thank God. We didn't want to celebrate too early. We still had the floor debate, and then we had to go back to the Senate. But with the Speaker's confirmation, we could feel more than just cautiously optimistic. When all the members had returned to the chamber, the House officially convened and took up our bill. Our prime sponsor, Brian Short, the handsome small business owner, did an excellent job answering questions on the legislation. He had perfectly retained all of the points we had laid out in a briefing book I put together the week before. Unlike in the Senate, we weren't going to spend time on our witnesses. We wanted to pass the bill as quickly as possible, and we hoped to get it over to the Senate that same day. Unfortunately, the Republicans weren't going to let us have it that easy. They knew that the longer they stalled, the less likely it would be that the Senate would take the bill up that night. And they knew that any delay would give the Delaware Family Policy Council a greater chance to destroy our slim majority in the Senate, however small their chance was. After fielding the predictable questions about bathrooms, locker rooms, liability, and other objections, Representative Short called up the compromise amendment. It passed with 25 votes, 4 more than a majority. It was a good sign, but it was still possible that several votes in favor of the amendment might not go with us on the overall bill. After the amendment was officially added to the bill, one of the wavering Democrats, an older man named Earl Jakes, rose to ask a question. Jakes, spelled J-A-C-Q-U-E-S, looks like a television evangelist, with big 1980s glasses and slicked back, thinning jet black hair. He hadn't historically been good on our issues. "I just want to make clear this amendment was meant to address the concerns some of us have raised regarding locker rooms," he asked of Short, a softball question that would allow our sponsor to give him clear cover. "Yes, sir," Representative Short responded with a smile on his face, demonstrating his appreciation for the easy question. "I wasn't sure how I'd vote on this bill," Jakes continued, "but last night I called my granddaughter. I told her we were considering this bill, and I asked her if she had heard the word transgender. She said, 'Of course, Grandpa. There's a transgender kid at my school.' And when I told her what the bill did, she was amazed that it wasn't already the law." This was a refrain we heard several times in legislative hall. Legislators couldn't understand the issue, but when they spoke to their kids or grandkids, they understood that there was a clear side to be on. A deeply religious man, Jakes closed, "And if Jesus can love the leper, then I can vote for this bill." A faulty comparison, to be sure, but given the circumstances, I'd most definitely take it. Jakes had made clear that his faith called him to the side of compassion, but his granddaughter had provided him with the answer. Throughout the fight for equality, young people have been on the front lines of change. When President Obama endorsed marriage equality in 2012, he cited something very simple for his change of heart. conversations with his daughters. Old Jake's granddaughter had given him a glimpse into the future. That, coupled with his own faith and a little political cover, provided him with a clear path to yes. Sensing the power of the moment and the permission that Jake's comment gave to other Democrats to vote for the bill, Short called for a roll call. Out came our checklists and pens, ready to tally the votes. One by one, the clerk of the House called out the names of members of the State House. My pen struck through the yes blocks next to each representative's name one at a time, but there was no need. We knew exactly who we needed by memory, having agonized over this list for weeks. After 41 names were called, the clerk read the results. 24 yeses, 17 noes, 0 representatives not voting, and 0 absent. Like in the Senate, the gallery exploded with cheers when the speaker gaveled the bill passed. We were on the brink of victory, but I felt like I couldn't exhale until the bill finally cleared its last hurdle and landed on Jack's desk. It still needed to go back over to the Senate for approval of the amended language. While it was too late to go back to the Senate that night, Senator Blevins kept her word and brought the bill up for a vote first thing the next day. The delay by the Republicans in the House had meant that Andy wouldn't be able to be there for the final vote in the Senate, as he had been for every other vote. But I knew he was there in mind and spirit. My parents and I sat in the same chairs we had occupied in the Senate 2 weeks prior. Mark, Lisa, and I all hoped that the debate would be short and we could pass the bill as amended without much debate. But when Senator Henry, again managing the bill on the Senate floor, tried to move things along rather quickly, the conservative Republicans, largely just out of spite, put a wrench in the operation. It was clear they were going to make us wait. "The fact that this bill has come back before us is a sign that this should slow down," remarked one conservative senator. "The people aren't ready for this." Karen Peterson, the openly gay senator who had held my hand while my parents testified the first time around, rose to speak. She was clearly annoyed that the Republicans were just delaying the inevitable and wasting everyone's time. "Do you need Sarah to come back up so she can remind you of the discrimination faced by this community?" she asked rhetorically, basically saying in so many words, "We can get Sarah back up here to lecture your asses again." Senator Henry seized the moment and popped up from her chair. "Roll call, Mr. President." For one final time, the clerk called the roll on SB 97. Confident that we still had our 11 votes, I looked up from my vote tally sheet and took in the moment. Each yes felt good, viscerally good, a needed affirmation for the trans people again gathered in the gallery. When each supportive legislator said yes, each of us heard something far more personal and powerful. We heard, "I see you, and I love you." When we reached that 11th vote, I let out a huge sigh of relief. We did it. I can't believe we did it. We fucking did it. Almost no one thought we would succeed. 6 months before, this bill seemed impossible to most. And people thought there was no way we could pass both marriage equality and trans protections. But over the last several months, hundreds of transgender people had written, called, and met with their elected representatives. Thousands of allies had spoken out. We had endured the indignity of the hate spewed at us throughout the process, and we had prevailed. Our voices had been heard, and our little state made history by taking one of the single largest leaps forward on equality of any state in 1 year. Trans folks from across the state crammed into the governor's ceremonial office on the second floor of Legislative Hall with us to witness the official signing. Jack walked in and gave me a big hug before taking his place at the lectern with the large seal of the state of Delaware on the front. I stood just behind him as he addressed the media and assembled crowd. "Today we guarantee that our transgender relatives and neighbors can work hard, participate in our communities, and live their lives with dignity and safety." As he continued to speak, he turned toward me. "I especially want to thank my friend Sarah McBride, an intelligent and talented Delawarean who happens to be transgender. Her tireless advocacy for passage of this legislation has made a real difference for all transgender people in Delaware." He then closed his remarks and asked if I'd like to say something. I nodded and changed places with him. "Today is a great day for Delaware, and I could not be prouder to be a Delawarean. I'm grateful for the compassionate and courageous legislators who stood up for basic fairness for all people, for the governor and attorney general's support, and for the LGBT activists and allies whose tireless work made this day possible. After today's vote, transgender people now know that Delaware is a safe and welcoming state for everyone to live and work. Tomorrow, transgender Delawareans will wake up and finally know that the state they love loves them too. Announcing, this is Senate Bill 97, Jack began to sign the bill, declaring, now with this signature, and effective immediately, it is in fact the law of Delaware. The room burst into applause as Jack held up the newly enacted law. It had been less than a year since Jack and I met up on AU's campus and talked about the need for this bill. Let's change that, he had said to me. And we did. 5 years after I stood behind him on the night he won the governor's office, I was now standing behind him as he signed the Gender Identity Non-Discrimination Act into law. After his victory in 2008, standing beside him, I felt hope for the potential for change. Now, as he held up the newest law of the land, I felt a renewed sense of hope. But it was a stronger hope than I'd felt in 2008 with both Obama and Jack's elections. It was a hope rooted in the progress that I had seen since coming out. And even though I had come out just a little more than a year before, and had been so frightened and so scared at the time, now I realized that I had never felt so hopeful. It was a hope displayed in the faces of the countless everyday LGBTQ Americans I helped welcome into the White House as guests of the President of the United States, of the openly gay Marine who proposed to his future husband in front of a Christmas tree just outside the Blue Room, of the transgender kids seen and affirmed by the nation's first black president. It's the hope infused with the warmth of finding love with the type of person who made me want to be a better person in every single way. And it's a hope that was now etched into the law of my home state, the only one to enact both marriage and trans equality in the same year. That night, my parents and I sat down for a celebratory dinner at a small neighborhood restaurant that we refer to as our happy place. This was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, my mom said. But it's also the most fulfilling thing I've done in all my life. And we did it together as a family, I toasted. As our glasses clinked, I got a message from one of the transgender people who had helped us pass the bill. He was out with his family at a restaurant, too. I'm out to dinner with my folks, it read. For the first time in my life, I feel like I belong here. This place finally feels like home. When you've never felt like you really belonged somewhere, it's almost impossible to know what it will feel like to finally feel at home. As openly transgender people, we had taken the steps we needed to alleviate that constant feeling of homesickness when it came to our gender identity. But without social and legal equality, as tranquil as we may feel within our own identities, our souls still ache for a physical home, a place where we can feel welcomed, affirmed, loved, and seen. It's a desire at the center of our shared humanity as people, and one that mirrors our own experiences transitioning. And while no law will ever be a silver bullet, no bill can change every heart or open every mind, and no protection can stamp out every act of discrimination, these laws provide a foundation. That night, we were one step closer to justice. Chapter 8. Will You Still Love Me? From coming out at the end of my term as student body president, to the experience at the White House, to the gender identity non-discrimination bill in Delaware, it had been an eventful year. Honestly, I was exhausted. But as ready as I was to move back to Delaware and settle down, I also felt compelled to continue the fight. In Delaware, I had seen the power of our voices to make change when they were matched with resources and institutional support. But throughout that effort, and particularly in the aftermath, I couldn't stop thinking about the people still denied the basic rights we finally had at home. Until every single LGBTQ person is protected by the law, and treated with fairness, our fight isn't over. A person's safety or dignity should not depend on their state or zip code. Equal means equal. But a majority of states still lacked the same basic yet critical protections from discrimination that we had just fought so hard for in Delaware. Arkansans and Texans and Virginians deserve these protections every bit as much as Delawareans and Californians and Minnesotans. As has been the case in every effort for basic equality, there is only so much progress that can be achieved by going state by state. National laws, such as the Civil Rights Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act, are necessary to ensure equal protection from discrimination, regardless of whether you live in the most conservative rural county or the deepest blue city. With the Delaware bill passed, I felt much more comfortable coming back to the state I love, but it was too soon. I didn't want to get mine and then go home, ignoring the widespread problems that remained. I wanted to help in any small way that I could to bring the change I worked on in Delaware to the nation. I knew that we could make strides at a national level, and I wanted to be a part of this important moment of change. In D.C., there were hundreds of advocates spread across dozens of organizations doing just that at places like the Human Rights Campaign, the National Center for Transgender Equality, and the Center for American Progress. Andy, who was one of those advocates in D.C., was a big draw for me to stay in town. Throughout my work on the gender identity bill, we would spend weekends together, alternating between Delaware and D.C., where he was still working at the Center for American Progress on LGBTQ equality in healthcare. While we could have maintained a somewhat long-distance relationship, after all, Delaware and D.C. are only about 2 hours apart, both of us were ready to begin the next phase of our relationship under the same roof. Delaware would always be there for Andy and me in the future. But for now, we both wanted to be part of what was shaping up to be a historic moment in the movement for equality. With more and more states passing marriage equality bills, and the decision by the Supreme Court in June 2013 striking down the nationwide act that barred federal rights and benefits to legally married same-sex couples, the momentum on that issue was picking up steam. Trans visibility was also increasing at a rapid rate. Laverne Cox burst into the mainstream consciousness with the premiere of Orange is the New Black on Netflix. That year, 2013, was eventually dubbed the transgender tipping point by Time magazine, and D.C. felt like the center of it all. I applied for a job on the same team as Andy at the Center for American Progress, the Washington-based think tank that has been called the brain of the Democratic Party. CAP worked on every policy issue, from the social safety net to national security to immigration to LGBTQ equality. The offices are located 2 blocks from the White House, and the 4 floors of roughly 200 employees were filled with both past and future Obama administration and White House staffers. Always a conscientious employee, Andy notified HR of his relationship with one of the applicants. They didn't see it as a problem. He wasn't part of the hiring process and wouldn't be managing the role I was applying for. And after an interview with the incoming director of the LGBT Research and Communications Project, I was hired for my first full-time job as an advocate. The team I would be working with was small, only about 7 employees. I was the most junior, but given my experience in Delaware, my focus would be on our work advocating for LGBTQ non-discrimination protections. The federal effort at the time centered on a bill known as the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which everyone called ENDA. In Delaware, and in most of the states that had passed non-discrimination protections, advocates had pushed for comprehensive laws that would protect LGBTQ people throughout life, from the workplace to housing and public spaces. But for the previous 2 decades, what was once a comprehensive civil rights bill had been whittled down to just protections in the workplace, the area of life with the most public support for passage of a law. The theory was that because employment protections were the centerpiece of non-discrimination laws, we'd focus on achieving those protections, and then build out the other protections incrementally, one bill at a time. First employment, then schools or housing, and then, down the road, public accommodations, which would include the dreaded discussion on bathrooms. The approach had its drawbacks. First, access to a job does not begin and end with the application process. It also includes access to shelter, goods and services, and a quality education.